From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Elvis Costello returns to the show to talk about his new CD and to perform some of his new and old songs. He'll play one song he co-wrote with Burt Bacharach. Also, 18th century poet, artist, and visionary William Blake. We talk with biographer Peter Aykroyd. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The government is ordering the recall of more than 91,000 Chrysler, Cirrus, and Dodge Stratus cars because of unsafe seatbelts. The deadline for the 1995 model cars is July 8th. Chrysler Corporation has already told the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration it won't comply with a recall order. That prompted the Justice Department to file the federal lawsuit forcing the automaker to tell owners and fix the cars for free. Israel's outgoing Prime Minister Shimon Peres met today with his successor, Likud Party leader Benjamin Netanyahu. It was their first meeting since Netanyahu narrowly defeated Peres in last week's elections. NPR's Eric Weiner reports from Jerusalem.
Despite the contentious election campaign, today's meeting between Peres and Netanyahu appeared to be cordial. The two discussed security issues and the transfer of power. They also reportedly talked about the tense situation in the West Bank town of Hebron. Prime Minister-elect Netanyahu has 40 more days to form a government. His Likud party does not have enough seats in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, to form a majority, so Netanyahu has been busy holding talks with possible coalition partners, including Israel's three religious parties and a new immigrants party headed by former Soviet dissident Natan Sharansky. Netanyahu also met today with U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Martin Indyk. This is Eric Weiner in Jerusalem.
The European Space Agency lost its brand new Ariane rocket today. It lifted off the launch pad in French Guiana in South America and then exploded a few seconds later. This was its first flight. The rocket was carrying four satellites. French television showed the burning wreckage of the unmanned rocket as it dropped back to Earth. The European Space Agency had played up Ariane 5 as its vehicle for a new age in commercial satellite technology, but the explosion is a big setback. A U.S. fighter plane was accidentally shot down in the Pacific Ocean today by a Japanese destroyer ship. It was participating in joint U.S.-Japanese military exercises. Japan has apologized for the accident. The BBC's Juliet Hindell reports from Tokyo.
The Japanese Defense Ministry has confirmed that a Japanese warship shot down a United States warplane by mistake. The incident took place during military exercises about 2,600 kilometers west of Hawaii. The ship has been named as the Ugiri. The American plane was an A-6 and had taken off from the aircraft carrier, the Independence. The crew of the plane have all now been rescued. Eight Japanese vessels are taking part in the six-nation exercises known as RIMPAC. In total, 30,000 military personnel are involved. The exercises take place every 2 years and last a month. Juliet Hindle, BBC News, Tokyo.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 45 points at 5,669. This is NPR. In Montana, the FBI is talking again with the anti-government activists known as the Freemen. Two FBI vehicles drove up to a gate at the Freeman Farm and apparently dropped off a note. A few minutes later, a man from the Freeman Farmhouse drove out to the gate and picked it up. It's the first visible communication between both sides in more than a week. It comes one day after the FBI cut off power to the farmhouse. The standoff is now 72 days old. Montanans go to the polls today to choose candidates for several offices, including governor, U.S. Senate, and the U.S. House. Jackie Yamanaka of member station KEMC in Billings looks at some of the key races.
For the first time since 1978, Montana's U.S. House seat is opening with the retirement of Democrat Pat Williams. On the GOP side, the race among Dwight McKay, Rick Hill, and Alan Mickelson is too close to call. Among Democrats, polls show Bill Yellowtail with a strong lead, But his candidacy has taken recent hits because of reports he was delinquent on child support payments. He once slapped his now former wife, and he was expelled from Dartmouth College for theft. Also on that ticket, Mignon Waterman, Leo Huditz, and Larry Gent. In the U.S. Senate race, Lieutenant Governor Dennis Rehberg holds a strong lead over Ed Borchert and Jack McDonald in the Republican primary. Finally, in the governor's race, incumbent Republican Mark Roscoe is expected to win by a large margin over challenger Rob Nadelson. For National Public Radio, I'm Jackie Yamanaka in Billings, Montana.
Salvage crews are still picking up wreckage from the Everglades Value Jet crash. Divers found a large hole at the southern tip of the crater where the jetliner crashed May 11th, killing all 110 people aboard. Searchers have pulled sections of fuselage as big as 5 or 6 feet out of the hole. They've also recovered human remains and personal belongings. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Advanta, a financial services provider to consumers and small businesses, and the presenting sponsor of the Cezanne exhibition, now through September 1st at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Elvis Costello has a new CD that was described in the New York Times as his best album in a decade. We invited him back to Fresh Air to talk about it, and much to our surprise, he brought his guitar and offered to play and sing. Elvis Costello has been making records since the mid-70s. His early recordings seemed emotionally driven by anger and frustration and musically inspired by the roots of rock and roll. Over the years, his music has reflected the influences of folk, jazz, American popular song, and all aspects of rock and roll. He's become one of the most influential and highly regarded singer-songwriters in rock. Let's get started with a track from Elvis Costello's new CD, All This Useless Beauty. This is Why Can't a Man Stand Alone?
Why can't a man stand alone? Must he be burdened by all that is taught to consider his own? His skin and his station, his kin and his crown, his flag and his nation, they just weigh him down. You know, pride is a sin that we tend to forgive, but it gets hard to live when you don't have the love in your heart to begin with. Why can't a man
Elvis Costello, welcome back to Fresh Air. A pleasure to have you back.
Thank you.
This is a wonderful song. Tell me about how you wrote it, when you wrote it.
Well, I had it in mind to write like a big, like gospel-based or R&B-based ballad of this kind with very clear lyrics. And in fact, I didn't know that I was really the voice for it when I came up with it. I had it in mind that Sam Moore might record it, from the singer from Sam and Dave. So I had it in mind to give it to somebody else to really sing it in a very forthright way. And I think it gave me the confidence to speak very clearly in the lyrics of the song in a way that I hadn't always done when I had to sing them myself. So a few years later, having sort of thought about the song and kind of plucked up the courage to sing it vocally, I mean, in terms of the music I'm saying now, not what it was saying, I found that I did have the confidence. I found the right voice on the record for it that wasn't too strident, that softened at the right moments in the story.
Why did writing for somebody else bring out new things in your songwriting?
Well, you can't afford to play with any ambiguities the way you can. I like the little nuances of meaning. I often bury in songs things which may be obscure to other listeners, but their particular personal references. And there might only be a passing line between two more important lines, but they're the things that give the song some strength to me when I perform it. Well, of course, unless you explain everything about your feelings and all of your thoughts, when you hand a song over to somebody else, I think it's essential that it's in clearer language. I like to play with the meanings and sometimes twist the meanings of songs so that I start out with it meaning one thing and then I go from one position to the next. But when I write for other people, I tend to make myself much clearer because obviously they're not me. They can't get it. You know, they can't get in my head and know what I'm thinking from moment to moment, know how I might inflect a line. They want it to mean what the words appear to mean.
You were saying that in a lot of the songs you've written for yourself, the meaning of the song changes as the song goes on, and that the song is most meaningful to you because you know all the subtleties of meaning in those lyrics. Can you think of a song that really illustrates that example?
Well, sometimes it's something comical, you know, like how a song may change over time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I started out with my first album, had a song on it called The Angels Want to Wear My Red Shoes, mm-hmm. which was about getting older and about slipping into the things that you always told yourself you wouldn't do as you got older. Well, the opening line is, I used to be disgusted, now I try to be amused. Well, when I sang it when I was 22 and I wrote it, 23 when it came out, I sang it with the anger of that youth, you know. Now, inevitably, there's a degree more acknowledgement that I've been both right and wrong in the time in between. And a more, perhaps, personal example is a song I've only just started doing recently on this last tour I've been doing with Steve Naive around the country, where we've been playing some of these songs. The second verse of the song is called, a song called Men Called Uncle. And it's about a man saying to his girlfriend, you know, well, you're going to go off with these older guys, there's no doubt. Well, of course, I was a young guy when I wrote it, you know. And the second verse goes, ever say you're the one, do you think that I'm serious? You get that kind of talk from older men. If I say I love you, then I must be delirious. So why are you trying to put my temperature up again? You see, I mean, obviously when I wrote that, you get that kind of talk from older men, it was me looking forward. Whether I like it or not now, that sounds funny because I am an older man now.
Right.
At least to some of the audience, thankfully. You know?
As our listeners have heard, you've brought your guitar, and I'm delighted that you did. I'd like you to play something, if you could, from the new album, maybe the title track, All
yeah,
This
okay.
Useless Beauty.
I wrote this song in Florence in Italy. I was spending a month there, and I was very lucky because I spent a lot of time in galleries and churches and all these places with beautiful paintings, and spent the kind of time that modern people usually are not allowed with works that were obviously painted or sculpted for contemplation. And I also spent a lot of time watching people looking at them, whether or not they glanced at them and ticked them off on a list and moved on to the next thing, or whether or not they came in and had their own thought with them. And on one occasion there was a woman who was looking at these beautiful, idealized statues and paintings, and then looked down at her husband, who was a less than perfect late 20th century model human, and started this song. It's a time such as this, she would be tempted to spit if she wasn't so ladylike. She imagines how she might have lived back when legends and history collide. So she looks to her prince, finding senses so charmingly slumped at her side. Those days I recall on the gallery wall, and she's waiting for passion or humor to strike. What shall we do? What shall we do with all this useless beauty? All this useless beauty. Good Friday arrived, the sky darkened on time, till he almost began to negotiate. She held his head like a baby and said, it's okay if you cry. Now he wants her to dress as if you couldn't guess
He desires to impress his associates, but he's part ugly beast and Italian deceased. So she finds that the mixture is hard to deny. Cosa potremo fare con tutta questa bellezza, con tutta questa bellezza inutile, all this useless beauty. She won't practice the looks from the great tragic books that will lay to disgrace to face celluloid. It won't even make sense, but you can bet if she isn't a sweetheart, a plaything or pen, the film turns her into an unveiled threat. Nonsense prevails, modesty fails, grace and virtue turn into stupidity, while a calendar fades, almost all barricades to a pale compromise. And our leaders have feasts on the backsides of beasts. They still think they're the gods of antiquity. If something you missed didn't even exist, it was just an ideal. Is it such a surprise? What shall we do? What shall we do with all this useless beauty, all this useless beauty? What shall we do? What shall we do with all this useless beauty, all this useless
Elvis Costello, thanks so much for performing that. And that's the title track from Elvis Costello's new record, All This Useless Beauty. We're going to take a short break here and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview I just recorded with Elvis Costello.
I understand you co-wrote a song with Burt Bacharach recently.
I did, yeah.
that you haven't recorded. How did you get together with him? And let me preface this by saying that his approach to songwriting is so different than yours, because he's an almost like post-Tin Pan Alley type of songwriter who's always written for other people.
Mm. Well, I think that he's not as dissimilar as it might appear, except in one obvious respect, that he is... he is classically trained to begin with,
mm-hmm.
and has a very broad experience, as you say. Wrote in the Brill Building, you know, and was simultaneously working with the Shirelles and Marlon Dietrich in the early 60s. So his experience of music is considerably broader and more varied than my own, where I started, you know, I really started out as a guitar-playing songwriter, whatever that's called, singer-songwriter it was called when I started out in the early... late 60s, in fact, when it was the first time I ever performed in public, it was in 1969, although I was very young. And so, you know, there's no point of comparison in that. But over the years, I have made reference to his style on a few occasions, a number of songs, quite a well-known song of mine that I did on my third album, Armed Forces, Accidents Will Happen, doesn't sound anything like him, but in fact I distinctly remember sitting down at the piano and trying to work out anyone who had a heart as a kind of model, as something that I wanted to approach.
Really?
And I had several songs in mind of the kind of complexity that he could achieve when I wrote that song, but obviously the way in which it was played by a rock and roll band like The Attractions, albeit a very, very, very capable band, wouldn't sound like the kind of orchestral pop that he produced, say, with Dionne Warwick. So later on, I tried on a number of occasions to write in his style. I even covered a couple of his songs. I covered Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself, and later on I covered Baby, It's You. But I wrote a song in 1978 called Just a Memory, which again is a fairly obscure one in my repertoire. There is a version of it on a record called Taking Liberties, and it's available now on a on a reissue of one of my albums. I don't even know which one.
And any chance that you could play a bit of the song that you co-wrote with Burt Bacharach?
I'd love to, but unfortunately it's a piano song and there's no piano in the room. And also, truthfully, we are in a talk studio here, and although sort of, you know, quiet ballads which are more conversational are possible, this is a song that really requires to be sung in a singing space. It's very rangy.
Could you do just a few lines of it a cappella? Just to give us a sense of the melody?
Well, I'll give you the sense. I mean, here's what, to answer your question, how did we write this? This is how we wrote. I met Burt in about 1988, I think it was, 89, when I was working on the record Spike in Los Angeles. And I was shamelessly stealing his instrumental arrangement devices to dress up a song of mine, a very long, unwieldy song called Satellite, which was on the album Spike. And I hadn't really found a successful way to arrange it, so I had employed timpanis and marimbas and lots of things, lots of the sort of sounds that I associate with his sort of orchestral pop arrangements, and making a bit of a hash of it, truthfully. He happened to be down the hall while I was doing it. It was like one of those very strange coincidences. And we met, and I played him the song, and he was very, very generous about our you know, shameless stealing of his devices. And we didn't really get in touch then, and we were put in touch in the course of this film that's being completed at the moment by Alison Anders called Grace of My Heart. And it's about a brill-building songwriter, an imaginary one. And various writers have been engaged to ghostwrite the songs, Jay Maskus, Joni Mitchell, myself on my own. And they came up with the idea of me and Burt Bacharach writing this song together, which is a big, dramatic, romantic ballad. Unfortunately, due to the deadlines of the film, we were unable to get together in the same room, so this song was written by fax and telephone line, which is one of the more terrifying things I've had to do in my life. I had to sort of make a start. I had a title, and I played just a demo, which will probably sound about as scratchy as these opening bars, of my opening statement of melody down the phone. Well, I was planning on playing it to Burt over the phone and talking him through it. Unfortunately, the day I called, he was out, and I got his answering machine. And anybody who's ever done that thing of saying something to the answering machine, only wishing there was some button you could press to erase it, will know the feeling of terror shortly after I put the phone down. I said, what have I done? I've just played this sort of scratchy little demo down the phone to this, you know, person I've admired for 20 years or more, and there's no way of clawing it back. Anyway, he was kind enough to ring back soon after and make, you know, some really wise choices of changes in the harmony. And shortly afterwards, some music appeared in my fax, and you know, that was the music for the next part of the song, and I fitted the words to it. And little by little, we pieced the song together over the next 10 days. So there you go. I'll just play a little bit of it.
Great.
Now I have nothing, so God give me strength, 'cause I'm weak in a way. And if I'm strong, I might still break. And I don't have anything to share that I won't throw away into the air. That song is sung out. This bell is rung out.
the light that I bless. She took my last chance of happiness. So God, give me strength. God, give me strength.
Hey, there was a little preview there.
I like that a lot.
That's it's a pretty tune. I mean,
let me ask you, I'm sorry. Was it interesting for you to hear Burt Bacharach's suggestions and additions, you know, additions and changes to your melody? I mean, what did you learn from hearing how they changed it? They weren't
the changes in the melody so much as the changes in the harmony, which are hard. That's why I say it's harder for me to express accurately what
like
the contribution
chords.
Just the voicings of the chords and the, you know, I mean, I tend to use simple, I'm a fairly rudimentary guitar player, and even more so on the piano, I can play my own sort of accompaniments, whereas he is a school musician who thinks both vertically and horizontally. I tend to think only horizontally.
You know what I really love? Is there any chance that you could play a couple of the lines the way you wrote it and then show us the harmonic changes that Burt Bacharach made?
There isn't really, no, because I would have to... For one thing, I can't remember what they were originally because this has become fixedly the version of the song. And secondly, you would need a piano to really illustrate that. You wouldn't hear it on the guitar.
Right.
It's very hard. I mean, what's interesting is I can play you a few bars of the bridge to show you the contrast, because that opening statement, with minus the amendments, is largely my invention, because somebody has to start things rolling. So the second time round it gets to the bridge, it goes,
God give me strength. God, if she'd grant me her indulgence and incline, I might as well wipe her from her memory.
See what I mean? That's where the problem is. It starts getting very high. And it's not really designed to be done in here, I don't think.
Right.
But, I mean, that's where the language of the harmony completely changes there, you know, And it goes into a whole other world, which I won't pursue now because it really doesn't sound like very much without the full accompaniment. You know, you need 20 strings and a couple of flugelhorns to go up there, you know.
Elvis Costello, he has a new CD called All This Useless Beauty. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Verve Records, presenting Now is the Hour, a new CD of romantic jazz moods from Charlie Hayden's Quartet West. Their website address is verveinteractive.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the visions of 18th century poet and artist William Blake. And we continue our conversation with Elvis Costello.
It started to come to me, your new career would probably end like this. All that professional lipstick, breast and do enamel to kiss. Farewell to the studded lines and care for broken hearts. The overpowering perfume and the glimpse of your garden. Mend them with the sweet smoking. Send out the martyr when it's starting to come to me.
Come to me, come to me.
Starting to come to me. So you began to recognize a well-dressed man that everybody loves. It started when you chopped off all the fingers of those bone and skin gloves.
you cut a hole out where the love light used to shine. Your tears of pleasure equal measure, crocodile and brine. You try to laugh it off, saying I knew all the time, but it's starting to come to me.
Come to me, come to me.
Starting to come to me. Sometimes you bring me down, play reluctant confidant. Say you may reward him if he gives you what you want.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Elvis Costello. He has a new CD called All This Useless Beauty. You know how you were saying that Burt Bacharach modified some of the harmonies on the song as you were writing it? I'm wondering, what when Chet Baker recorded your song Almost Blue, did he and the musicians who he played with change any of the harmonies on the song?
Well, the accompaniment is so sparse, it's very hard to hear any of the harmony. I mean, it's a pretty much a found melody, you know. I mean Chet Baker sang "The Thrill Is Gone" like this. The thrill is gone. The thrill is gone. You know, it's just like that. It's like a plain vibrato-less, like just plaintive tune.
And The Thrill Is Gone is the song that inspired in part, Baker's version of The Thrill Is Gone inspired in part your song Almost Blue.
Yeah, Almost Blue. And I mean, you can hear the similarities here.
Almost blue, almost doing things we used to do. There's a girl here and she's almost you, almost all the things that your eyes once promised, I see in hers too. Now your eyes are from crying, almost blue. Flirting with this disaster became me. It named me as the fool who only aimed to be almost blue. It's almost touching, it will almost do. There is part of me that's always true, always. Not all good things come to an end, now it is only a chosen few. I have seen such an unhappy couple almost be almost you, almost blue.
Gosh, I love that song. I really like the way you did it, too. That was just wonderful. You wrote Almost Blue with Chet Baker in mind because his recording of The Thrill Is Gone kind of inspired your song. How did Chet Baker get his hands on your song?
Well, I gave it to him. I gave him a copy of it. He came in to play on a record of ours called Shipbuilding, which was a, a very unlikely song. It was music by a friend of mine, Clive Langer, and words by myself. And it was written during the Falklands War. And I heard a plaintive voice, and I didn't really know who I wanted. You know, I mean, my absolute ideal of the record was Miles. And I didn't think in a million years I would be able to get Miles. And by sheer chance, like, we no sooner started recording, but I opened the paper one day and Chet Baker, who was a very elusive character and very rarely kept to any kind of predictable schedule, usually scheduled dates at very short notice, suddenly appeared in London. He hadn't played in London in about 15 years. And the very week we were recording, he turned up in London playing a little club date. And I went along and introduced myself, and he had absolutely no idea who I was, except I was one of the more polite people in the club. You know, that was a very, very noisy club full of jazz critics talking, ordering drinks at the tops of their voices, you know, and giving him absolutely no respect. And I said, would he come down and play a session? And he turned up the next day with his trumpet and played this trumpet solo. And at the end of it, I gave him a copy of the record, Imperial Bedroom, which contained Almost Blue, which was the previous record we'd made, mm-hmm. and said that I'd written it with him in mind and perhaps he'd like to listen to it. And a few years later, I heard a rumour that he was doing my song. But although I had seen him several times in the meanwhile, he had never mentioned any interest in the song. And although I had given him a copy of the record, he never mentioned it, and I never pressed him on it. And shortly after his death, somebody told me that he had recorded it, so I didn't hear his version until after he died.
Do you know, by the way, that he has there's a new Chet Baker concert recording coming out from 1987 in which he does Almost Blue again?
I didn't know that. No, I would be very interested.
It's on a small label called Evidence, and it's not out yet, but it's coming out.
Oh,
and
I
it's a really beautiful version of it. I heard an advanced tape of it.
I mean, I find the version that's in the
on the movie,
film
it's great.
Almost unbearable to watch because he's found himself there in a situation that I saw him in several times, where he's got a lot of loud drunks who are pretending to be jazz fans sitting at the back of the room, not allowing him to do what he did very well, which was create an incredibly fragile mood. And I can't even watch the film. It upsets me too much to see it, even though I'm obviously was very thrilled that he recorded the song, even though he was in fairly extreme shape when he did so, you know.
Do you think your singing has been influenced by Chet Baker's singing?
Not really, because I sing with a very wide vibrato. I try to keep it under control. Sometimes I do try and just kill it completely. I've got a strange vibrato. When I'm tired, it comes out very broad. And I start to take on more like a Billy Eckstein type of vibrato, but I don't have that kind of rich voice. My voice, I have a much bigger range than people think I do. I've got quite a wide range. You know, it's from two octaves below middle C F to top B flat. So I can't use all of those confidently, all of that area confidently. And the middle register is the warmer. And the upper part is very loud and obnoxious, as you've already heard, but it can be very exciting in the right kind of song. I've tried to listen to all the singers. I mean, lots of different singers have influenced me, but I don't sound like any of them. And I've listened, you know, with great attention to Sinatra and to Billie Holiday, but equally to Van Morrison, Rick Danko, mm-hmm. And numerous other people. And people that people would never think in a million years that I've listened to avidly, like Joni Mitchell. Who obviously I don't sound anything like, but has been very influential. And one or two songs on this record, I think, compositionally have some owe some debt to her writing, you know. I Want to Vanish, the final song on the record.
I think perhaps the biggest surprise I've heard from you lately is on an album of duets from a concert last year with the jazz guitarist Bill Frisell.
Yeah, I love that record, yeah.
Yeah, one of the songs you do is Gigi.
Yeah. Well, I love these songs, you see.
Yeah.
I mean,
why'd you choose this particular song? And I wonder, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, it's because I can't get through I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face Without Crying. Now, I love Gigi because it's on the one hand a very, very sexy song, but on the other hand, it's also kind of a little strange and perverted, you know?
Yes.
And
right.
And I don't think that side of the... I didn't want to make it really creepy, but I think there is a very strange eroticism to it, particularly if you listen to Bing Crosby's late version of it.
Just because it becomes an older man singing about a girl who's just turning into a woman.
Yeah, and there is something very erotic about it in a beautiful way. I don't think we should be afraid of those things. We're in danger of getting too politically correct now. There are some things that can be commented on without them becoming salacious, you know? And I really love the song, and it's beautiful. And I did this, I mean, I met with Bill Frisell. He's a wonderful composer, wonderful guitar player. I was the director of a festival in London where I invited people such as the Jazz Passengers, the Fairfield Four, many of whom now I've either recorded with or I'm about to record with. And Bill and I did our set together, in which he arranged several of my songs and Giles Mingus's Weird Nightmare, which we had played on together on Hal Wilner's Weird Nightmare record, and Gigi. And it's just a beautiful song. And that was like a lot of jazz guys release records of their first meetings and then go on to do more substantial work later. I hope we get the chance to do it, you know.
Elvis Costello, it's just been such a treat to have you here. Thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for bringing your guitar and playing for us.
Yeah, it was fun. Thank you.
Gigi, am I a fool without a mind, or have I merely been too blind to realize? Oh, Gigi, why you've been growing up before my eyes. Gigi, you're not at all that funny, awkward little girl I knew. No, overnight there's been a breathless change in you. Oh, Gigi.
Elvis Costello from the CD Elvis Costello and Bill Frisell, Deep Dead Blue. Elvis Costello's new CD is called All This Useless Beauty. Coming up, the visions of poet William Blake. This is Fresh Air. In one of his poems, William Blake asked, "Why was I born with a different face? Why was I not born like the rest of my race?" Perhaps what most separated him from others was his visions, visions which began when he was a child and later influenced his poems and engravings. Biographer Peter Aykroyd opens his new book by acknowledging that he can't follow Blake into that private world, but Aykroyd does his best to understand it. Blake's work was neglected during his lifetime in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Today he's considered a genius, perhaps best loved for his songs of innocence and experience, and his poems and engravings inspired by the Old Testament. Before we meet Aykroyd, let's hear a recording by poet Allen Ginsberg, who has set many of Blake's poems to music. This is Blake's poem, The Sick Rose. Ginsberg says he had a visionary experience the first time he read the poem in 1948.
Rose, thou art sick, the invisible worm that flies in the night in the howling storm has found out thy bed of crimson joy, and his dark secret love does thy life destroy. Oh, Rose, thou art sick, the invisible worm that flies in the night in the howling storm has found out thy bed of crimson joy, and his dark secret love does thy life destroy. Rose, thou art sick, the invisible worm that flies in the night in the howling storm has found out thy bed of grief.
crimson joy. And his dark secret love does thy life destroy.
That's Allen Ginsberg from his 1970 album Songs of Innocence and Experience. I asked Peter Aykroyd why he wanted to write a biography of William Blake.
Well, I've written several novels and biographies which have been broadly concerned with what you might call the London visionary tradition. I've written about Charles Dickens, for example, and I've written about Nicholas Hawksmoor, Thomas Chatterton, and other figures from England's past. And I've always been interested in writing about William Blake because he sort of culminates what I call the Cockney visionary tradition in English letters, a born Londoner who never left the city except once in his life, and yet who managed to see in the streets and buildings of London the fabric of eternity. For me, it was a natural consequence to writing the biography of Charles Dickens, whom in some ways he resembles.
Blake had visions ever since he was a child. What kind of visions did he have as a child?
Well, as a child, he had visions of angels and of prophets and of God, funnily enough. He was one of those individuals who had the ability to reimagine what they had already read, in the sense that in his childhood, the Bible was the mainstay of his reading. Not only was it read to him, it was also recited to him by his dissenting parents. And he had an extraordinary gift of being able to recreate it all around him, the images which he'd already understood through words. And normally, one gathers that this is a gift reserved generally for children who do it quite intuitively and unselfconsciously. But in Blake's life, it was a gift which was heightened and elaborated as he got older, so that in his 50s and 60s, he was surrounded by these visions, to the extent that he, in his prophetic epics, he created a whole mythology in order to explain and understand them.
When we say he had visions, what do we mean? Were they hallucinations? Were they dreams? Could he tell the difference between his visions and reality?
It's difficult to know whether he wanted to know the difference between them. Apparently, the 20th century word for these phenomena is eidetic imagery. And it's a capacity which has been shared by people like Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Charles Dickens himself, for example. What it means is that what people think they can actually see. Now, there are some people who make a very clear distinction between these visions and so-called reality. But Blake was someone who never trusted the dimensions of ordinary reality. So for him, these visions, these hallucinations, were actually as real, as important, and as significant as the so-called real world, which was all around him. There were times, of course, when he feared that he was going mad because they were so persistent and constant, these visions. And you might say that half the achievement of his life was to try and make sense of these visions, to persuade himself that, in fact, he was not mad, that the insanity which other people thought he suffered was simply a form of second sight.
How did the visions that he had change through his life?
They became more elaborate and more, I would say, painterly, in the sense, since they reflected so closely his own development as a reader and his own development as an artist, we might say that as his art deepened and became more complicated, so his visions strengthened and became more extraordinary. Certainly, he continued to have them until the very end of his life. And his wife said, Mr. Blake is hardly ever in my company. His awes in eternity, by which she meant that he was so surrounded by these visitations that he felt sometimes quite uplifted from the ordinary world.
In Blake's time, the late 18th and early 19th centuries, were artists seen as people who were often visionaries, or were his visions considered a very uncommon thing?
Well, when Blake chose to describe them, they were treated as rather singular and unique. But of course, there is a tradition of visionary painting and visionary poetry in England, as there is in Europe. Many of Blake's contemporaries, for example, were under the influence of laudanum or opium and saw different kinds of vision. There was also a spiritual Christian visionary tradition of which Blake was partly inherited. But I would say that on the whole, his visions were so unique, so
comprehensive and so persistent that he really is in a class of his own.
In what way were they unique?
Well, they were unique because they were so fully formulated that he not only saw angels, he spoke to them. He writes in some of his artistic prefaces that he was taken in vision back to incredibly ancient cities. He speaks of being with Socrates and being with Jesus, and he speaks of the sun turning into a golden host surrounded by angels. It needn't necessarily be that one should take all these things completely literally, but it's certainly the case that he created this whole mythic system of which his visions were a part, and in that sense they were quite unique.
Let me ask you to describe one of his paintings which seemed to come directly out of one of his visions.
Well, there's the famous painting called The Ghost of a Flea, which is of a rather large dragon-like creature with a tongue, red tongue, licking out, holding a chalice of blood in his hand. And this was a vision which Blake said he had, I think, in Lambeth, when he lived in Lambeth, and which he described in great detail to a friend of his, and which he painted up at a later stage. And he even described having a conversation with the flea, and was told that the souls of angry or wrathful people became fleas, and how high fleas could jump, and all the rest of it. And the actual painting itself, if you look at it, I think the original is still in the Tate Gallery in London. The actual painting is a very vivid and actually rather frightening image. It certainly doesn't look as like a hallucination. It looks like a sort of damned souls trapped inside the canvas. And if you believe in these things, I'm not sure that I necessarily do, but if you believe that these visions were in fact real, you'd have quite good evidence for it in this particular case.
Well, do you believe his visions were real?
I believe they were real for him, and therefore they become real for us because of his artistry. Then you get into argument about what reality is, you see, and that's something, of course, which he spent his life trying to explain.
My guest is Peter Ackroyd. He's written a new biography of poet William Blake. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Peter Ackroyd. He's written a new biography of poet and artist William Blake. You describe him as an intense visionary who believed in brotherhood and the human community, but he never seemed to actually belong to that.
No, he was always very much of an outsider. He said in one of his epic poems, "I must create a system or be enslaved by another man's." And there's no doubt he had a sort of Cockney pugnaciousness, a sort of individualistic streak, which made him very highly unsusceptible to the ideas and opinions of other people. He never went to school because his father realized that he was not going to be very happy in any kind of institution of that kind. And he was more or less completely self-educated. Certainly his the myth he created in his poetry was completely of his own devising. And the art which of which he became so accomplished a practitioner is almost completely without predecessors in English terms.
What about Blake's wife, Catherine? What was she like, and what was their marriage like, you know, given that he was so absorbed in his own inner reality?
Well, Catherine, they met when they were very young, and they stayed together all their lives. They were a childless couple, but in a sense they didn't need children because they were happy just to care for one another. She implicitly believed in her husband's genius to the extent, in fact, that she shared his visions. One friend said that she was the madder of the two because, in a sense, she shared the visions without really understanding what they were all about. But not only did she participate in his life in an obvious sense. She also worked with him at the presses. You have to remember that he was a journeyman, an artisan all his life, and printed out his own material, coloured, printed, and you know, and the rest of it. And Catherine actually helped in that manual and technical work side by side with her husband.
Was William Blake a religious man?
Yes, he was very deeply religious. He, although you can't suggest, although one can't suggest he was part of any particular sect or creed, he was born of dissenting parents, and all his life he retained a sort of, well, how can one put it, a sort of a dissenting individualistic faith. He spent some of his apprentice years in Westminster Abbey, and was profoundly affected by the religious imagery within that particular church. And throughout his life, he continued to draw and redraw, paint and repaint various forms of spiritual imagery. In a sense, you might say he was the last great religious artist England ever produced.
When you say his parents were dissenters, what was that dissenting tradition that they were part of?
Well, it was just that we don't know the exact sect of which they were a part, in fact. But they were part of the very broadly dissenting tradition of Londoners in the mid-18th century, some of them became Methodists, some became Wesleyans, some became Thraskites, Salmonites. There were so many different names for the variety of sects. But it was part of a sort of what you might call the radical artisan shopkeeper class of London in that period, who tended to be radical, as I said, and tended also to be dissenters. They were a recognisable group of Londoners in a recognisable place and time.
There's a few lines that you say kind of sum up Blake's philosophy. He wrote, "To see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour." Tell us about those lines.
Well, Blake was always very impressed by certain forms of mystical and visionary philosophy, the work of Paracelsus, the work of Jacob Burma, the work of Swedenborg. His was a vision of the world which was not mechanical or materialistic, but a world which was imbued with spiritual properties and spiritual forms, so that any part of the world, as it were, contained every other part. And in phrases of that kind, which you just mentioned, it's a very clear indication of the kind of religious sensibility at work in his poetry and in his prose.
I thought it was very interesting. You write that when Blake died, his friend George Richmond kissed him and then closed his eyes to keep the vision in.
George Richmond was one of those younger artists who took up Blake in his old age and who realized at least something of his genius. And there's no doubt that the visionary capacities which he believed he had began to be recognised in his old age, and that as far as George Richmond was concerned, Blake was the last great master. He said as much himself in a variety of ways.
Peter Ackroyd has written a new biography of William Blake. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from William Morrow, publisher of Kenneth C. Davis's new book, Don't Know Much About the Civil War, Everything You Need to Know About America's Greatest Conflict But Never Learned. This is NPR, National Public Radio.